Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Threat, Risk, and the Invention of American National Security. Andrew Preston. In the spring of 1961, having been in power only a few months, a wide range of complicated foreign policy crises beset President John F. Kennedy. Cuba, Berlin, and the Congo posed a difficult set of problems, but none befuddled him as much as Indochina, where communist insurgencies brewed in both Laos and South Vietnam. Both were thought to be pivotal to Southeast Asian security and to America's strategy of containing communism in the Western Pacific. Yet both were entering new phases of crisis. While Laos seemed to teeter on the brink of collapse, South Vietnam appeared to be entering a new period of instability. Only months before, the North Vietnamese had sponsored the establishment of the National Liberation Front, NLF, the movement that aimed to topple the anti-communist government in Saigon, and that soon became better known as the Viet Cong. The dilemma that faced Kennedy, as it had President Dwight D. Eisenhower before him, was how the United States should respond. In parting words of advice, Eisenhower had told Kennedy that Laos was worth defending to the point of war. By implication, the same applied to South Vietnam, indisputably the more important of the two countries. But was Indochina really worth it? Kennedy needed a closer look. He couldn't go himself, so instead, in May 1961, he sent Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson on a tour of Southeast Asia. Johnson visited several countries, including Thailand and the Philippines, as well as South Vietnam, and upon his return to Washington, he spelled out the stakes in no uncertain terms. The battle against communism must be joined in Southeast Asia with strength and determination, Johnson warned, or the United States inevitably must surrender the Pacific and take up our defenses on our own shores. The basic decision in Southeast Asia is here. We must decide whether to help these countries to the best of our ability or throw in the towel in the area and pull back our defenses to San Francisco and a Fortress America concept. This was pretty dramatic stuff, but it wasn't simply political rhetoric to sell a difficult policy to the American people. It was part of a top-secret report LBJ prepared for Kennedy. And it was hardly unusual. Officials in both Kennedy and Johnson administrations penned hundreds of similar assessments of South Vietnam's supposed importance to U.S. national security. Johnson himself continued to argue that the fates of South Vietnam and the United States were somehow inextricably linked. After Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963, Johnson escalated American involvement in Vietnam because, as the security situation deteriorated in South Vietnam, the security risks to America increased. If communism wasn't halted there, he believed, there was no stopping its spread, even to the shores of California. As he put it, in characteristically homespun language, to his national security adviser, McGeorge Bundy, "If you start running from the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen." And in his landmark speech at Johns Hopkins University in April 1965, Johnson was perhaps more eloquent but no less clear in explaining the security stakes in Vietnam. "This will be a disorderly planet for a long time. In Asia, as elsewhere, the forces of the modern world are shaking old ways and uprooting ancient civilizations. There will be turbulence and struggle, and even violence. but we will always oppose the effort of one nation to conquer another nation. We will do this because our own security is at stake. Such extreme views of the stakes in Vietnam were discredited almost as soon as Johnson uttered them. Even at the time, many people asked how a small, poor, faraway country could be deemed so vital to the security of the world's richest and strongest military power. It seemed outlandish then, and it still does today. But despite his bravado, Johnson was not an ignorant man, nor was he stupid. If he held an extreme view of America's security requirements, he did so for a reason. By the time Kennedy and Johnson held the presidency in the 1960s, the definition of U.S. national security had been stretched and expanded in previously unimaginable ways. It was not unusual for Americans to perceive their security frontiers as global. Indeed, it was considered natural, but it hadn't always been thus. In fact, the tradition of globalized national security was not all that old. By 1961, it had been around for roughly 20 years. In the late 1930s and early 1940s, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, several of his key advisers, and a small number of sympathetic public intellectuals deliberately invented a new concept, national security, which broadened the parameters of American self-defense beyond almost all recognition. During the world crisis of the late 1930s, Roosevelt and his allies were interventionists. They did not advocate that the United States should become a full belligerent against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, but they did want the U.S. to play a much greater part in resisting fascism. The vast majority of American people, however, did not. Thus, in order to convince Americans to become more involved in world affairs, Roosevelt deliberately broadened the terms of what was required to defend America. He turned foreign policy from a matter of choice to a matter of necessity. Before Franklin Roosevelt, the American conception of self-defense was narrow and limited. It meant, as it has for most states over the past several centuries, defending the territorial sovereignty of the nation-state. These terms were codified as the Caroline Standard by Secretary of State Daniel Webster in 1837. The Caroline was a U.S. ship sitting just inside U.S. waters in the Niagara River, which divides New York State from the Canadian province of Ontario, then a British colony known as Upper Canada. A Republican, pro-independence rebellion had just broken out in Upper Canada, supported by sympathetic Americans on the New York side of the border stationed on the Caroline. In suppressing the rebellion, British troops attacked and sank the ship, in the process killing an American citizen. Webster vehemently protested and, in his famous standard, declared that self-defense was only justified in response to a direct physical attack upon territorial sovereignty. According to Webster's Caroline Standard, preemptive self-defense was virtually impossible to justify. This became something of a problem for the George W. Bush administration in 2002 to 2003, when Webster's doctrine, by then 165 years old, received renewed attention and fresh controversy due to the invasion of Iraq. For the next 100 years, between the eras of Daniel Webster and Franklin Roosevelt, it was relatively easy for the United States to adhere to the Caroline Standard. Unlike most great powers in human history, Americans enjoyed free security, that is, the United States was free from attack and invasion by a rival power. This was due to a geopolitical fluke. Vast oceans separated America from Asian and European powers, and the other nation-states of the Americas were not remotely strong enough to threaten the United States. Under such conditions, the American tradition of isolationism flourished. The term national security was still virtually unknown, and it is revealing that presidents did not go to war in the name of self-defense against a foreign threat. The one exception was James K. Polk, who engineered a confrontation along the Mexican border in order to seize California. But his rationale was exposed as spurious at the time, and not accepted as genuine, even by supporters of the war with Mexico. The advent of globalization in the late 19th century, then called interdependence began to shift American thinking on security. As military technologies increased in their sophistication and ability to project power over long distances, and as intercontinental and transoceanic communication and transportation became much easier, some Americans began to question the assumptions of free security and deride the tradition of isolationism. Among them was the naval captain Alfred Thayer Mahan, who argued that navies were becoming too powerful for the United States to remain aloof from world affairs. His thinking gained adherents in Washington, as well as in London, Paris, Berlin, and Tokyo, and it underpinned the strategic approach to war with Spain in 1898 and the annexation of the Philippines a year later. Secretary of State John Hay then dealt free security and isolation a further blow by issuing the Open Door Notes of 1899 to 1900, which declared to the other great powers that the integrity of China was a matter of America's vital interests, and that the United States would look dimly upon any other power's attempt to subjugate China. In the First World War, President Woodrow Wilson built upon the notions of Mahan and Hay to fashion a new strategic doctrine. The United States waited until April 1917, nearly 3 years, to join the war in Europe. But while such a development seems inevitable in retrospect, it certainly wasn't at the time. In fact, in terms of self-defense, there was little rationale for going to war with Germany. The United States had done quite nicely out of the war. Industry boomed as it met demand for goods from warring nations in Europe, and Wall Street replaced the City of London as the hub of world finance in 1916, thanks to mounting Allied war debts. And Germany posed only the most remotely theoretical threat of invasion. This dynamic changed somewhat when the Germans resumed unrestricted submarine warfare in February 1917, which had led to sufficient losses of American life and prestige that by April, Congress was ready to declare war. In his war address, however, Wilson emphasized America's obligation to world community and civilized societies, and he promised that American power would help construct a more just and stable world order. But he did not argue that the United States went to war out of self-defense. Still, in positioning the United States as a nation among nations, and by stressing the interconnectivity of world affairs, he came closer to justifying war as a matter of self-defense than any other president since James Madison in 1812. Excepting, of course, Abraham Lincoln in 1861, whose war of self-defense had an internal dynamic all its own. After the war, with no threat apparent to the United States, the Senate rejected American membership of the League of Nations and refused to authorize the stationing of U.S. troops in Europe to guarantee French security. Wilson had shifted the requirements of American security slightly, but he could not budge the reality of free security, and America retreated back into strategic isolation. This was the problem that Franklin Roosevelt and the interventionists faced during the world crisis of the 1930s. They not only had to devise an effective strategy to confront the Germans and Japanese, they had to overcome isolationism at home. In fact, their chief problem wasn't isolationism. While there were certainly die-hard isolationists who wanted to retreat into Fortress America, most Americans wanted their country to engage with the wider world. There were also Anglophobic and anti-Semitic isolationists, such as the celebrity aviator Charles Lindbergh, who did not want America to become partners with the British and the Jews. These extreme views were not uncommon, but they did not represent the majority of American opinion. Instead, most Americans were anti-interventionists who did not want the United States to get involved in the security problems of Europe and East Asia. The best way to maintain U.S. security, they argued, was to be active diplomatically but not militarily. It was to be neutral and not to take sides. Leading this viewpoint was former President Herbert Hoover, who argued that the Nazis were odious and that Americans had a responsibility to help alleviate the suffering the Germans had caused. but Hoover also pointed out that neither Germany nor Japan had the capacity to attack and invade the continental United States. Because the security of American territorial sovereignty was protected, Americans should refrain from intervening directly in the security problems of others. In fact, Hoover argued, if the United States did intervene, it would bring about insecurity. Intervention was thus counterproductive, because it would actually make the United States less secure. Hoover not only had logic on his side, but also popular and congressional opinion. So what was FDR to do? His response was to expand the terms of what constituted American self-defense. It was powerfully effective and has defined American national security ever since. He did not, of course, invent the modern doctrine of national security out of nothing. He was helped along by events in Europe and Asia, especially the stunningly swift fall of France in June 1940, the German invasion of the Soviet Union a year later, and the Japanese encroachment into Indochina in 1940 to 1941. It also helped FDR's cause that thanks to the advent of air power, a direct attack on the United States was plausible for the first time since the War of 1812. Yet this was still unlikely, and it's striking that the president who told the American people that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself was now building his foreign policy on the politics of fear-mongering. It's telling that in the period 1937 to 1941, Roosevelt used the phrase national security more than all other presidents before him combined, going all the way back to George Washington. What did FDR mean when he invoked the term national security? The United States, he declared on several occasions in this fateful period, was in danger, its very survival at stake in the same way it had been in 1776, 1814, and 1861. But now the danger was indirect, dependent on a chain reaction of events inevitably unfolding to reach American shores. It was no longer possible, he said shortly after the German conquest of France, for the United States to remain a lone island in a world dominated by the philosophy of force. On another occasion, he pointedly referred to Nazi Germany as a rattlesnake and contended that when a person sees a rattlesnake poised to strike, you do not wait until he is struck before you crush him, especially when the rattlesnake in question was not simply a military enemy, but an enemy of all law, all liberty, all morality, all religion. FDR's mention of morality and religion revealed another crucial component to his vision of national security. The danger was also to American values, which he conflated with the integrity of America's territorial sovereignty. In other words, the safety of American values was now indistinct from the safety of American territory. In a world of industrial-scale mass ideologies such as communism and fascism, neither values nor the nation-state could survive without the other. In his 1939 State of the Union address, he pronounced, "There comes a time in the affairs of men when they must prepare to defend not their homes alone, but the tenets of faith and humanity on which their churches, their governments, and their very civilization are founded." This was a revolutionary statement. In it, Roosevelt was telling Americans that they should fight for their values. By contrast, the founders in the 18th and early 19th centuries had been proud for the United States to be an island of democracy in a sea of despotic power. They expected no less from America and no more from the rest of the world. But for FDR, that would no longer do. Where American values were at risk, so too was American security. If democracy was in danger, so too was the United States. It was here that the modern doctrine of national security was born, global and ideological as well as territorial and physical. It promised to protect Americans from all threats around the world, no matter how remote. As FDR explained in December 1940 in one of his most famous and stirring pre-war addresses, "This is not a fireside chat on war," he began. It is a talk on national security. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. I have the profound conviction that the American people are now determined to put forth a mightier effort than they have ever yet made to meet the threat to our democratic faith. After the Japanese attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor in December 1941, Roosevelt's vision of national security became the commonly accepted definition of American self-defense. It provided the basis on which U.S. forces fought a global war on two separate transoceanic fronts, and it provided the basis for American post-war planning that produced international organizations such as the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, later renamed the World Trade Organization. A new world order had been created, undergirded by American values and U.S. military and economic power. But in such a new world order, who was to define the limits of American security? Who could now distinguish between American national security and overall international security? Thus, while it helped pave the way for American intervention against Germany and Japan, the capacious ideology of national security was hard to turn off. It outlasted the war and provided the basis for America's Cold War with the Soviet Union. By posing a threat to American values, and by seeming to stand at the start of a global chain reaction process that would be difficult to stop once it got started, the Soviet Union seemed to present a threat as grave and as imminent as Nazi Germany had posed just a few years before. The irony here was sharp. Franklin Roosevelt may have thought that post-war peace would only last as long as the US and USSR were able to cooperate, but his successor, Harry Truman, didn't share that view. In fact, Truman deployed FDR's doctrine of national security against the Soviets themselves. One may fault Truman's foreign policies, but once the new strictures of national security were laid down, it was difficult for him not to apply them to international communism and Soviet power. This returns us to John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Vietnam. It was no coincidence that both Kennedy and Johnson took part in Franklin Roosevelt's war of globalized national security. Both witnessed hostile engagement with the Japanese in the South Pacific, far from U.S. shores. Kennedy wounded in action at sea, Johnson on a presidential fact-finding mission to Australia. And so both had personal experience of the new front lines of American self-defense. For them to see South Vietnam as integral to American safety was not such an unreasonable leap of logic. If U.S. security against a remote threat was dependent on a tiny atoll in the South Pacific, why not Indochina? The doctrine of globalized national security has endured. The American defeat in Vietnam did nothing to diminish it. It was founded in the strategy of containment of the 1940s and 1950s, and was blooded by the Vietnam War. But it survived and was revived by Ronald Reagan to resist the Soviets' evil empire in the 1980s. It underpinned Bill Clinton's strategies of full-spectrum dominance and global enlargement in the 1990s, and it propelled the George W. Bush doctrine of preemption and the global war on terror. So long as the United States is the guardian of a liberal internationalist world order, and so long as U.S. military power remains strong, the ideology of American national security will continue without limit.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation, and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.